Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Myasthenia gravis affects 14 to 40 individuals per 100,000 persons in the United States. Complicating matters, a plethora of medications have been associated with acute exacerbations, including most commonly antibiotics. Despite numerous reports of antibiotic-induced myasthenic crises, little guidance exists to assist providers. Today, Dr. Andrew Webb, a pharmacist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, aims to provide us with practical recommendations for choosing safe and effective antibiotics in this patient population.
So on a day-to-day basis, many of you likely don't encounter patients with myasthenia gravis regularly. However, this disease state can have profound impacts on the skeletal muscular function of our patients. And many medications that we use on a day-to-day basis can potentially interact with that. So a solid understanding for pharmacists and all clinicians is crucial to make sure we're having safe and effective medication therapies for our patients. So to start out, I thought it'd be good to just poll the audience. So I'd like you to please take out your cell phone or your computer and go to either pollev.com/MayoRx or text this code to MayoRx to 22333. I'll present you with this potentially common clinical case. Suppose you have an 85-year-old female who presents with symptoms of community-acquired pneumonia. She has a past medical history of myasthenia gravis. Of these agents, what would maybe be your go-to agent to empirically treat this patient's pneumonia? So I, like you, initially would probably agree. Ceftriaxone and azithromycin is kind of our standard of care as empiric coverage for community-acquired pneumonia. However, this is actually a trick question, as none of these options are appropriate in this particular patient, either due to an interaction with the disease state or an inappropriate coverage of the common bacteria causing pneumonia, or potentially both. So hopefully throughout this presentation, I can demonstrate to you why some of the most common antibiotics we use on a day-to-day basis may have potentially deleterious effects for our patients. So briefly for my objectives, I'd like to just have you be able to describe the pathophysiology of the disease state, outline some of the literature available that supports avoiding certain antibiotics in these patients, and finally, I hope you'll be able to select a safe and effective treatment regimen for a patient with myasthenia gravis who has a bacterial infection. So briefly, myasthenia, as you may be aware, is a rare autonomic neuromuscular disease that affects the skeletal muscular function of our patients. Its prevalence is estimated around 20 cases per 100,000 individuals. So while it's not certainly the most common disease state, it's likely one that you will encounter throughout your career. Similarly, in terms of presentation, somewhat of a bimodal presentation with an early onset form of myasthenia gravis happening before the age of 50, as well as the more common late onset disease that happens after the age of 50. And as I'd mentioned, myasthenia gravis is a disease of the neuromuscular junction. And having a solid understanding of this important physiologic unit is important to understand not only how the disease works, but additionally how certain agents, antibiotics, as well as other medications can potentially interact with it. So I'd like to just orient you to this diagram. You can see in yellow, there's a motor neuron, which is the axon terminal of a nerve that runs and then sits on top of a muscle cell or a muscular unit, which is in that pinkish color. And in between that the nerve and that muscle is a synaptic cleft. This is a small space that allows for the passage of ions, neurotransmitters, as well as the presence of enzymes which can regulate the process. So at rest, there's a resting membrane potential that surrounds the cell membrane of all of our neurons. And in our motor neurons, there are acetylcholine-filled vesicles that are within the cytoplasm of those nerves. One of the key players in maintaining that resting membrane potential is this voltage-gated calcium channel. So these calcium channels lie on the axon terminals of our motor neurons and are actually plugged partially with a magnesium ion, which helps to prevent calcium ions from rushing into that cell terminal, which would cause a depolarization. So at baseline, magnesium is helping to maintain those voltage-gated calcium channels, so there's not unnecessary firing or unnecessary depolarization. However, when a depolarization does happen, when we're trying to actually contract a muscle, that depolarization will travel down the nerve, remove that magnesium ion, and open up that voltage-gated calcium channel, which will allow calcium from the extracellular space to enter into the cytoplasm of our motor neurons. This influx of calcium will actually push the acetylcholine-filled vesicles to the cell membrane of our motor neurons, releasing that acetylcholine into the synaptic space. Now, on the other side of things, in the muscle cell, there are acetylcholine receptors, as you can see in these little bunches of yellow, which are present on the cell membrane of all of our muscle cells. However, as you can see here, they're fairly spread out, diffuse, and not well organized. So at this point, if acetylcholine were to bind to these receptors, while it would activate those receptors, there would not be a strong depolarization, and it likely would be a weak muscular contraction. So there's another player I'd like to introduce to you that maybe you weren't taught in physiology in school, which is a tyrosine-linked kinase receptor that's made up of two proteins, muscle-specific kinase and lipoprotein-related peptide. So these two proteins make a complex that, when activated by a compound called agarin, actually function to chaperone all of the acetylcholine receptors into a concentrated form on your muscle cells. Now that your acetylcholine receptors are fairly well concentrated, brought together on the surface of your muscle cell, when acetylcholine does bind to its receptor, that will open the sodium channel that that receptor is responsible for activating, allowing sodium to pass through the muscle cell, which causes a strong muscular contraction. Now, once this is complete, likely many of us are familiar with the enzyme acetylcholinesterase. This is an enzyme that's present within that synaptic cleft, so when acetylcholine is released from its receptor, the acetylcholine can be metabolized into its individual units, and it can be recycled for further use. This also prevents unnecessary re-depolarization of your muscle cells, which can cause fatigue and paralysis. Now, this entire process that I just went through happens in about 10 milliseconds. It's incredibly rapid, it's automatic, but there's many players throughout this. It's a multi-step process where every single step needs to occur for strong, healthy muscular contractions. So you can imagine there's a variety of different pathophysiologic mechanisms that may interfere with the function of our neuromuscular junctions. And this is exactly what happens in myasthenia gravis. So as I had mentioned previously, myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune condition. So in this disease state, your immune system is actually producing antibodies, as we have represented here in teal, which are specific for particular players in that neuromuscular junction function. So the most common subtype of myasthenia gravis is acetylcholine receptor positive myasthenia gravis. And this is where your immune system is producing antibodies specific to those acetylcholine receptors. So it's competitively inhibiting the binding of acetylcholine, which prevents those sodium channels from opening and prevents strong muscular contractions. Two other subtypes I'd like to introduce are antibodies specific to muscle-specific kinase, as well as antibodies specific to lipoprotein-related peptide 4, which, while they differ from their immunogenicity, they produce the same symptoms and generally are treated the same as well. There are other subtypes, including subtypes where no specific antibody is actually detected, as well as one other subtype I'd like to mention here is ocular myasthenia gravis, which is an interesting, more mild form of this disease, where in up to 15% of patients with myasthenia gravis, their symptoms are localized solely to their eye muscles. So that manifests as ptosis or drooping eyelids or diplopia or double vision. And these patients may or may not be positive to any specific antibody. And I'd just like to point out that patients with this particular subtype, if they progress with no progression of symptoms after 2 years, rarely have systemic manifestations of the disease. So I'd just like to make you aware of this particular type of the disease. Now, many of us are likely thinking of, how do we handle this disease? How do we treat the symptoms and the underlying disease state? And generally speaking, when you have a patient present with myasthenia gravis, the first step is symptomatic treatment. So pyridostigmine is an oral acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, which will increase the amount of acetylcholine available in the synaptic cleft, which will hopefully allow the acetylcholine to overcome some of that competitive inhibition from the antibodies. However, if patients do not get remission of symptoms from this alone, the next step is stepwise immune suppression, hopefully reducing the burden of antibodies, which can restore the function of the neuromuscular junction for these patients. So agents like prednisone, azathioprine, mycophenolate, and rituximab can all be used in these refractory patients who do not get good symptom control with pyridostigmine alone. However, my talk's not about myasthenia gravis treatment. It's about antibiotic use in these patients. And I highlight this specifically because these agents, as immune suppressants, can put patients into a dangerous cycle. So patients who present with myasthenia gravis potentially will require immunosuppression for disease control. This puts them at an increased infection risk, which may lead them to getting inappropriate antibiotics, which may worsen their myasthenia gravis, and you can really see how you might get into a dangerous cycle. So true judicious use of antibiotics in these patients is important to avoid worsening of their disease states and potential morbidity and mortality. Now, I mentioned morbidity and mortality in these patients, and what happens if you don't get good disease control in these patients? And the worst manifestation is a myasthenic crisis. In these patients who don't have good disease control, who have progressive worsening of their neuromuscular function, they can develop a rapid, progressive muscular weakness. They often require mechanical intubation or non-invasive ventilation like BiPAP or CPAP. And this is not in the setting of postoperative management where we've given them neuromuscular blockers and are managing their airway on purpose. So this particular manifestation of myasthenia gravis can be fatal if patients are not adequately managed from an airway perspective. In terms of what causes myasthenic crisis, there's a wide variety of triggers. And I'd just like to highlight as a caveat to the rest of my talk that infections themselves are potential triggers for myasthenic crises. However, timing some particular intervention or some particular event can be good to try to elucidate what maybe is causing that myasthenic crisis. And into a third to up to a half of patients with myasthenic crisis, there's really no clear cause. However, as all clinicians who handle medications, pharmacists and otherwise, it's good to recognize that a number of medications can contribute to these symptoms, and not just antibiotics. So medications such as antiepileptics like phenytoin, magnesium, as that can affect the function of that calcium channel at your presynaptic terminals, and antiarrhythmics, which are sodium channel blockers themselves, can all potentially contribute to worsening of symptoms in patients with myasthenia gravis. So from a mechanistic standpoint, there's two main ways that antibiotics and other medications can interact with the neuromuscular junction, a presynaptic mechanism as well as a postsynaptic mechanism. So presynaptically, certain antibiotics have been identified to interact in two main ways. The first is actual inhibition of those calcium channels. And I highlight here that they're P-type calcium channels, just to differentiate from L-type calcium channels, which are the channels that medications such as amlodipine or diltiazem inhibit. So this will prevent adequate depolarization of your presynaptic neurons, which will then prevent the release of acetylcholine into that presynaptic terminal. Medications such as the macrolides are a good example of this. The next presynaptic mechanism is inhibition of acetylcholine release. So certain antibiotics, such as polymyxins, can actually infiltrate the cell membrane of neurons and prevent the release of those acetylcholine-filled vesicles into the synaptic cleft. And from a postsynaptic standpoint, there are also two main mechanisms. Firstly is actual inhibition of that ion channel. So antibiotics such as fluoroquinolones can plug the pore that sodium will typically travel through, which would prevent a depolarization from the postsynaptic standpoint. Similarly, inhibition of the acetylcholine binding site, such as the action of streptomycin, can actually competitively inhibit the binding of acetylcholine to that receptor, which prevents that opening of the sodium channel. So for my first assessment question, this is going to be a little different than many of you are likely used to. So I suppose you have a patient who receives a dose of azithromycin and suffers respiratory failure. A dose of calcium chloride is given, and a patient recovers. So on this diagram on your phone or smartphone or computer, when you go to polev.com/mayorx, I'd like you to select on the diagram where you likely think azithromycin is functioning in the neuromuscular junction. Don't mind the color change. That's just so everything shows up nice. Awesome. Yeah, so I'm getting some strong responses for that calcium channel. So in this particular patient, giving calcium chloride likely was able to restore the function of those calcium channels, which was able to restore the function of the neuromuscular junction. So moving forward, as I had mentioned, many antibiotics that we use can potentially produce a myasthenic crisis. However, as you may have guessed, there are no large clinical trials randomizing patients with myasthenia gravis to a potentially harmful antibiotic and a potentially safe antibiotic. So the two main sources of literature that we have supporting the potential risk with these agents are case reports and in vitro data. And particularly, as I had mentioned previously, there's a strong sense of bias in all of these case reports, and that the infection that these patients are being treated for may potentially also contribute to their symptoms. So because of this, I'd like to propose an evidence grading system that's a mixture of my own interpretation of the evidence that's available, as well as some of the recommendations for the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America, which produces a document recommending certain agents to be avoided. So as you can see here, on the left-hand side, there are medications which pose minimal to no risk of harm in patients with myasthenia gravis. And on the right-hand side, I'll notate medications that have a high probability of harm if they were to be used in a patient with myasthenia gravis. And the first class of antibiotics I'd like to talk about are fluoroquinolones. So from a mechanistic standpoint, as I had mentioned previously, these have a class effect of actually blocking that sodium ion channel. So they prevent sodium from traveling through that ion channel, which does not allow for a strong depolarization of your muscle cells. And there's a good chemical reason for this. So fluoroquinolones are marked chemically by the quinolone moiety in their structure. as you can see here with ciprofloxacin. And these seem to resemble a quinoline moiety in the medications like quinidine, as you can see here. So these two biheterocyclic structure portions of this chemical structure seem to have similar mechanisms that they can inhibit sodium channels, which may be contributing to these symptoms. In terms of the clinical literature available, there's a literature in FDA Adverse Event Reporting System review of reports from 1970 to 2011, which identified 37 cases collectively of respiratory distress being caused by fluoroquinolones. 70% of these patients had myasthenia gravis at baseline. The median onset of action was within a day to 2 days of taking a dose of fluoroquinolone. They had respiratory symptoms, and 30% of these patients required invasive ventilation to manage their airway. So I mentioned that 70% of patients had myasthenia gravis at baseline. So in 30% of those patients who otherwise had no other risk factors for depressed neuromuscular function, these agents alone seem to produce enough of a blockade of that function to cause respiratory symptoms. So this is probably just another reason to avoid fluoroquinolones, among all the other toxicities that they can potentially cause. As these have potentially, this can potentially cause harm in patients who maybe don't even have neuromuscular disease at baseline. So because of this publication, the FDA actually added a black box warning to all fluoroquinolones on the market to avoid their use in patients with myasthenia gravis. So I would say these patients, these medications have a high risk of harm in patients with myasthenia gravis at baseline. Now, the next class of medications I'd like to speak about are macrolides. So as I alluded to previously, macrolides as a class effect seem to inhibit calcium channels presynaptically, which prevent the release of acetylcholine downstream. Now, unlike fluoroquinolones, these don't have a strong, you know, case series publication to support this risk. But there are several case reports with azithromycin, erythromycin, as well as clarithromycin that have been associated with myasthenic symptoms soon after being given a dose. And there's just two cases I'd like to highlight specifically that very well illustrate this. So the first is azithromycin. So this is a 13-year-old boy who had myasthenia gravis at baseline who presents with pneumonia, was given a dose of IV azithromycin, and within 10 minutes of that dose finishing, reported respiratory distress requiring intubation. Second is with erythromycin, which is a very similar case, of a 15-year-old girl with myasthenia gravis at baseline presenting with pneumonia, given a dose of erythromycin, and for the ID folk in the room, this was published in a foreign country in the early 90s, so antibiotic coverage was a little different back then. But during this infusion, this patient reported respiratory distress requiring intubation. So because of this, with azithromycin, erythromycin, and clarithromycin, the macrolides that we commonly see in clinical practice, I would say there's a moderate to high risk of harm in giving these agents to patients with myasthenia. And just for historical perspective, I'd like to just briefly talk about telithromycin, which is likely an agent you haven't heard much of anymore. It's actually removed from the market in 2016 because of a litany of toxicities, including potential myasthenic exacerbations. But this has an additional mechanism of actually blocking those acetylcholine receptors postsynaptically as well. There's a case series published not soon after this agent was approved in the mid-2000s in 10 patients who all experienced respiratory distress, most of whom very soon after taking that oral dose, so not even an intravenous dose, and 6 of them required a prolonged hospitalization because of this alone. So with this case series, with telithromycin specifically, the FDA actually added a black box warning to this agent. So while this isn't something that maybe you'd see prescribed very often, if you potentially maybe have a patient from overseas who's coming to Mayo Clinic, I would say there's a high risk of harm if that patient happened to have myasthenia gravis. Now next, aminoglycosides is the next agent and class of medications I'd like to speak about. So neomycin, gentamicin, tobramycin, and streptomycin have all been implicated in impairing the function of the neuromuscular junction. And from a class mechanism standpoint, they all seem to also inhibit the calcium channel similar to macrolides. However, neomycin and streptomycin, which have been implicated as potentially the more toxic of the aminoglycosides, have additional mechanisms, including blocking that actual sodium ion channel or blocking the binding of acetylcholine to its receptor. In terms of in vitro data, the risk of these agents seems to have been stratified into neomycin causing the most depression of the neuromuscular junction, with tobramycin appearing to produce the least. And I'd like to highlight neomycin specifically, as this was actually the first agent to be identified to have this potential toxicity. So in the 1950s, when neomycin was all the rage, this was being used surgically for intraperitoneal administration. And there were several case reports of patients experiencing unexplained apnea after being given neomycin. And of the 6 cases that were reported in the mid-1950s, 4 of those died because of the apnea. So while intraperitoneal neomycin may not be the most common medication administered to your patients, those of you who may interact with GI surgery may know that this is commonly used in GI prep. And there are case reports in the surgical literature of oral neomycin being used for GI prep, causing respiratory dysfunction. So it's definitely good to have that in the back of your mind. And I would say if your patient has myasthenia gravis, there's a high probability of harm with this agent. Now, if you are going to use an aminoglycoside, likely gentamicin, tobramycin, and amikacin are going to be your drugs of choice. And while there's in vivo and in vitro data available supporting the toxicity in these patients, at least in their neuromuscular junction, case reports are sparse. And this is likely because we've known aminoglycosides have this toxicity for 50 to 60 years, so we've already been avoiding it. However, one area that's sort of interesting, and there are case reports of toxicity with ophthalmic preparations. So even patients who just get eye drops, tobramycin eye drops for, say, an eye infection, there's a case report of a patient experiencing profound respiratory distress, even due to that small administration and absorption of tobramycin. So while case reports in myasthenia are not very common with these agents, there are studies in the surgical literature. So you can say that neuromuscular blockers can kind of function as a synthetic model of the disease in terms of synthetically blocking the neuromuscular junction. And there was a study in patients receiving tobramycin and gentamicin and placebo versus, and also receiving vecuronium or atricurium for surgery. And while there wasn't an effect with atricurium, in patients who received gentamicin or tobramycin and vecuronium, well, vecuronium is expected to have a 45 to 60 minute on a duration of action. Patients who received aminoglycosides had a 2 hour duration of paralysis. So a potentially significant effect in these patients. So I would say there is a moderate risk of harm with these agents, simply because we don't have a lot of strong literature out there, but the mechanism is definitely there. Now, next, I'd like to briefly talk about clindamycin and lincomycin, which are chemically and mechanistically similar to our aminoglycosides and our macrolides. And from a mechanism standpoint, they seem to block those calcium channels, as well as also block the binding of acetylcholine to its receptor. And while there are actually no direct reports of myasthenia gravis exacerbation in terms of worsening of respiratory function, similarly, there is also case reports in the surgical literature. And one I'd like to highlight is a 25-year-old woman with a penicillin allergy who required a C-section. She had preeclampsia, received magnesium appropriately for that. Because magnesium can modulate that neuromuscular junction, she received a reduced dose of rapacuronium for paralysis, was given clindamycin preoperative or perioperatively for her antibiotic prophylaxis. And despite the fact rapacuronium has about a 20-minute duration of action, this patient was paralyzed for 90 minutes. So whether this is a combined interaction with the clindamycin and the magnesium or not, it clearly shows that this agent may potentially interact with that disease state. And I would say that there's a moderate risk of harm, even though there's not strong literature, but the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America also recommends avoiding these agents in these patients. So the next agent I'd like to talk about, again, while you may not see this very often, are polymyxins. From a mechanistic standpoint, these seem to infiltrate into the cell membrane of neurons and inhibit the release of acetylcholine presynaptically. And while there are a few case reports in myasthenia gravis, again, there's a number of case reports from the 1950s and 1960s in the surgical literature reporting apnea in these patients. And it's unclear whether these patients had myasthenia or whether they're just experiencing neurotoxicity from the polymyxins themselves. However, there is a potential risk for harm. And while I would say there's a moderate risk of harm, I would like to pause here and say if you have a patient with myasthenia gravis who's potentially requiring a polymyxin, of course a risk-benefit should always be weighed in these patients. Or if this patient is already mechanically ventilated, potentially has a severely resistant pseudomonal pneumonia, it may be worth using an agent like this if this is required, as long as you have the understanding that there may be underlying risk factors in a patient with myasthenia gravis. Now, lastly, with the specific agents, I should mention vancomycin and beta-lactams, with ampicillin specifically being the beta-lactam I mentioned. Now, there's very limited evidence for concern in myasthenia gravis, as from a mechanistic standpoint, these have not been well elucidated, such as the mechanism for fluoroquinolones or macrolides. However, there is some in vitro data that they seem to interact. It's just not quite clear how. In terms of the evidence, there is a single case report of vancomycin causing respiratory symptoms in a patient with myasthenia gravis, although that was the only case report and was published very recently. So up until that point, there's very scant literature supporting its risk of harm. And in ampicillin, there's only case reports of causing limb weakness in patients, no case reports of actual causing respiratory distress. So while these do have a theoretical risk, and these are listed by the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of being potential agents to avoid, I'd say there's a relatively low risk of harm in these patients. So it's a consideration to have, but likely safe to use if this is the most appropriate agent. So for my next assessment question, this is also going to be a little different. So this is a free text response. So say you have an elderly patient who's admitted to the floor with a suspected urinary tract infection. She has a past medical history of heart failure and myasthenia gravis. I'd like you to pre-submit an inappropriate antibiotic that would be potentially harmful or inappropriate to treat this patient's infection. So yeah, I would agree that generally speaking, fluoroquinolones, aminoglycosides, somebody suggests a polymyxin for a UTI, that would also be questionable. But there are a number of antibiotics which we may commonly see in our patients used for UTIs, which would potentially be harmful in this particular patient because of that interaction at the neuromuscular junction. So I just presented lots of information of antibiotics that you can't use. So you're probably thinking, what can I use for my patient with myasthenia gravis? And luckily, there are a number of agents which have either no reported toxicity in these patients or in some cases reported to be safe in these patients. So most beta-lactams, apart from ampicillin, which has that theoretical risk, appear to be safe in these patients. So our cephalosporins, as well as our classic piperacillin-tazobactam, appear to be safe to use. Similarly, doxycycline or minocycline appear to be safe in these patients, although there are some theoretical concerns with tetracycline as an agent itself. There's been no reports of toxicity with doxycycline or minocycline. If you'd like to avoid vancomycin for MRSA culture, if you have a high concern of toxicity there, daptomycin and linezolid are potential options to use. Linezolid actually has case reports of it being safely used in patients with myasthenia gravis. Although daptomycin does have some concerns in terms of muscular function, so you should, of course, monitor creatine kinase with that. Similarly, if you'd like to avoid clindamycin for anaerobic coverage, you always have metronidazole. And similarly, folate antagonists such as sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim appear to be safe in these patients as well. So I'd like to just briefly go over some of the disease states where you may commonly encounter some of the antibiotics that you'd like to avoid in these patients. Now with pneumonia, the 2019 CAP guidelines came out about an hour ago, so this is hot off the presses. So they still recommend using a macrolide in combination with a cephalosporin. So if you'd like to have atypical coverage, you can still use doxycycline. It has a low level of evidence, but a good recommendation in that case. So cephalosporins and doxycyclines is a great option in these patients. Similarly, if you have more of a hospital-acquired concern, beta-lactam, beta-lactamase inhibitors such as piperacillin and tazobactam appear to be safe in these patients. And of course, avoiding fluoroquinolones, macrolides, clindamycin, and aminoglycosides are all judicious for us to do in these patients. For urinary tract infections, similarly, this is a disease state where you may encounter fluoroquinolones, potentially aminoglycosides if it's somewhat complicated. And ampicillin. Ampicillin has that kind of dual low risk of harm, but also high risk of being resistant to your common organisms. But you can still use the first-line guideline-recommended agents, such as sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, nitrofurantoin, fosfomycin, or cephalosporins. And lastly, intra-abdominal infections are likely the other type of infection where you may encounter fluoroquinolones, aminoglycosides, or clindamycin commonly. And again, cephalosporins and metronidazole, beta-lactam, beta-lactamase inhibitor combinations, and carbapenems, if you'd like to go down that road, are all potential options to treat these infections. So for my final assessment question, I'd like to revisit that case which I introduced at the beginning of the slide. I did make a slight alteration here, so hopefully you can catch that out. But we have an 85-year-old patient with a past medical history of myasthenia gravis who presents with community-acquired pneumonia. Of these regimens, what is the most appropriate empiric choice? Yeah, so I would agree. I say ceftriaxone and doxycycline will provide adequate coverage for the most common bacteria that you'd be concerned about in community-acquired pneumonia and has no supposed risk in a patient with myasthenia gravis. The other agents such as levofloxacin and telithromycin have black box warnings in patients with myasthenia gravis. And while ampicillin sulbactam has a relatively low risk of harm, this may not adequately cover all of the bacteria that you'd be concerned about, as you still should want to cover those atypicals in your elderly patient presenting with community-acquired pneumonia. So in conclusion, many antibiotics, as well as many medications that we commonly use, have effects at the neuromuscular junction and may be harmful to our patients with myasthenia gravis. Aminoglycosides, fluoroquinolones, and macrolides are the most strongly associated with myasthenic crisis, although the quality of evidence is relatively low. And if you have a patient with myasthenia gravis, very careful consideration should be taken to all the medications used to treat that patient, but particularly antibiotics, as these have been shown to have devastating effects in terms of intubation, prolonged hospitalization stays, and as well as mortality.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.